Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am well.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, Christmas movies in November. What is this Christmas creep all about? How can we combat it? It's too late to... Wait, hold on. Sorry, I'm getting a bulletin in my earpiece that I'm touching, but you can't see it because we're not doing video. Apparently, there was an election last week, and this is largely a politics website slash news magazine slash journal of ideas, so we should probably cross the streams a little bit here. All right, so to remind everybody, Donald Trump defeated Kamala Harris at the polls. It was not particularly close. Arguments about the cause of this defeat continue. Was she too progressive in the 2019-2020 primary in a way that hurt her with moderates in a series of ads? Did she cozy up to conservatives too much in the waning days of the campaign rather than trying to shore up her base? Did she lose ground with every minority group except black women because she is a black woman? Was she put in an impossible position by Biden refusing to drop out? Who can say? Those are all questions better answered by other podcasts and writers on this site. And I'm sure they'll tackle all of it. But I did want to highlight one small angle that has kind of come up repeatedly over the last few days that will be germane to this corner of the website. Writing in Variety, Chris Willman says that it's time to stop blaming celebrity endorsements for Harris's loss. Here's Willman, quote, "The idea that entertainers and artists' involvement somehow leads to actual voter dissuasion is a fantasy. Bullshit that is happily perpetrated by the go woke, go broke crowd and picked up by columnists who think that picking on limousine liberals never goes out of style. To be fair, it really doesn't. It's just disappointing to see this picked up by objective journalists and by some Democrats themselves who imagine that they have practical reasons to tell the entertainment world to shut up and sing," end quote. I want to read one more quote, this one from The Bulwark's own Sarah Longwell on Twitter. Her focus group podcast, I say this all the time, and don't tell Sarah I said it, but I say this all the time. Her focus group podcast is routinely the best, like, most revelatory show we run, because she is talking directly to actual voters about their actual concerns rather than filtering, you know, all the conversations through pundits and journalists. And here's what she tweeted on the matter over the weekend. Quote, "I haven't heard a single voter across dozens and dozens of swing focus groups point to VP Harris doing events with Liz Cheney as a negative. I have, however, heard a lot of annoyance over all the celebrities permeating the campaign. As one voter said, quote, Beyonce ain't paying my bills," end quote. And end quote for the whole thing. There are two broad ways to think about celebrity activism. On the one hand, you have general get out the vote efforts, right? And this is what you see at, like, big concerts and stuff, right? You know, these are kind of, oftentimes these are nominally nonpartisan, or if they are, they're, like, less partisan. The theory being, you know, if we do big concerts in swing states and people like Springsteen and Beyonce and Taylor Swift fans, they kind of skew left, right? So if we register lots of voters there, we'll pick up lots of Democratic voters, the Delta will grow, etc. And maybe that's true. I'm a little bit skeptical of this, at least insofar as it's a bank shot. I'm not sure it's worth the hassle. And the point of using these pop stars, right, is that they have a broad appeal. And if you have people with broad appeal making, you know, get out the vote efforts, you're going to end up capturing a lot of people in a polarized country like the one we live in who are going to be voting for the other side. So I am a little skeptical on this. Second way to think of activism is purely in endorsement terms, right? And so this is why you have Joy Reid on her TV show saying, like, it's a big deal that Queen Latifah has never endorsed, and she's endorsing Harris. I mean, she never endorses anyone, and here she's making an endorsement. That has to sway people, right? And that's insane. That's just an insane thing to think. I don't think it helps in any real way. I actually do think it creates a modest problem for Harris and other Democrats, right? If you have every single big-time celebrity back her with near unanimity, it just reinforces the idea of Trump as an outsider, that he's an agent of change, that he's outside the system. He's the candidate of the little guy, not the George Clooney's of the world, but, you know, the little guy. In an election that was defined largely by bread and butter concerns about inflation and the such, and a sense of anti-incumbent, anti-elite antipathy, having everyone from, again, Clooney to Beyonce to the whole cast of Avengers out there making robocalls for Harris was probably at least a little counterproductive. No one thinks Iron Man is worried about the cost of eggs. Alyssa, is this just my innate cranky conservative coming to the fore, or was this a real issue for the campaign?
I think it's really, really hard to disaggregate any given sort of get out the vote effort from the larger headwinds that the Harris campaign faced. But I do think that in an anti-incumbent sort of pocketbook election, yeah, the celebrities probably don't help that much. I mean, I think it's one thing if, for example, like, you know, Taylor Swift had spent the whole Eras tour doing voter registration and sort of turnout encouragement for a year beforehand. But on the other hand, you know, Kamala Harris wasn't the candidate then, right? I mean, it's just, it's very hard to do sort of counterfactuals or to disaggregate any of this stuff. But that said, I do think this was an election where a lot of voters seemed sort of averse to the idea of being told what to think or what to do. And I think a lot of that messaging was particularly clear around the economy, right? Like, people don't appear to have liked being told that actually the economy is great when they were still feeling frustrated about inflation. In that case, I think it's very hard for me to say confidently that, like, celebrities weren't helpful. But it doesn't seem like they are actually helpful in turning anyone out at this point. And yeah, I don't know.
And I do think, and one thing I think that's worth saying here, just saying out loud, is that, like, I think it's totally understandable that celebrities who feel like they want to make a difference. They want to use whatever influence they have to get people out there. I'm sitting here all day tweeting like an idiot, right? Why should I not shut up while, you know, the celebrities out there have to? Like, right? I get that. I totally understand that frustration.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that this gets back to some of the questions kind of raised by effective altruism, right? Like, what is the most effective thing for, you know, any one of us to do in any given moment? And, you know, if you are a celebrity, there may be a tension between doing what feels good and what is actually helpful, right? Like, you know, sort of wanting to be politically active, especially in a way that maybe curries you favor with some of your fans, versus what is the most important thing to do for a campaign. And, you know, I think, but again, this is an election where it's kind of hard to tell what the helpful thing would have been, right? Because, you know, the Harris campaign raised $1 billion and was able to spend that on, you know, a lot of advertising. Matt Iglesias has pointed out that in some places, you know, in some of the swing states, you know, the margin was actually, you know, smaller than might have been expected. And there is maybe some argument that some of that campaign messaging was useful and helpful, and that Harris was able to perform better than she could have otherwise because of the money. But again, this is, it's really hard to know what the effective and helpful thing for anyone to do is when you become the nominee 100 days before the election. And, you know, I think it's maybe a broader structural thing for both Democrats and stars to figure out what the hell their role is in the campaign. Maybe it's just to raise money in the future. But I think with the sort of political incentives in fandom shifting some, and you know, for corporate entities as well, and, you know, politics itself maybe shifting a little bit, I think it is worth Democratic strategists and politically active celebrities taking some time to sit down and actually try and figure out what's most useful, as opposed to what's most sort of personally satisfying.
Yeah, Peter. Part of this discussion that, like, makes me feel like I'm going insane is that, like, we're talking about, like,
it's not this discussion, Sonny. you're just going insane.
All discussions. But part of this specific discussion that really makes me think I'm losing it is, you know, we're having an argument about the margins of celebrity here, essentially saying like, well, should Beyonce be doing this? Should, you know, Taylor Swift be doing that? Why is George Clooney weighing? And like, the simple fact of the matter is that Donald Trump is the ultimate celebrity president. Like this bizarre world that we've constructed where we're like, well, the celebrity shouldn't weigh in to stop the celebrity television guy from being president is bonkers. It's a bonkers thing.
Right. Well, and this celebrity television guy who's bringing out Hulk Hogan and Dana White and Amber Rose and like, you know, I mean, I think obviously there is a celebrity skew in Hollywood. There's just absolutely no question that that's true. But it's not like the right doesn't have its own brand of celebrities, right? I mean, look, for God's sake, like Tucker Carlson is a celebrity, even if he's not a Hollywood celebrity. You know, he is a media icon. And so in addition to the candidate, there are sort of big media figures on the right as well.
It's like how Sonny is a film Twitter celebrity.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I should just keep it to myself.
Well, so I think a couple of things here. The first is that celebrities are people who are in America. I mean, for the most part, that means they have every right to say whatever the hell they want about the election. If that's what they want to do, go for it. But the second thing I would say is they should think about what it is that they're trying to do. This goes to Alyssa's point. Is this going to be effective in achieving your political goals? I think maybe in some cases it might not be. Maybe in some cases it just makes no impact at all. But for a lot of celebrities, part of what they're doing is the same thing that a lot of people are doing when they go to the polls and vote, or when they post online, or when they engage in political discourse or action of any kind, which is it's an expressive act. It's affiliative. It's about sort of defining themselves, for their peer group, for anybody else in the world who can see them. And the thing they want out of it, whether or not this is a good thing to want, but the thing they want out of it, at least as much as anything else, is to define themselves a particular way, to be known as this type of person. And for a lot of people, I think there's a kind of satisfaction in that. And for celebrities in particular, they are constantly, again, whether or not they're good at it or whether or not this is, you know, sort of effective for their political goals is a different question. But for celebrities, they are constantly trying to define themselves in the public eye, and that includes their political goals and views, because that's a way of sort of telling people what kind of a person you are. We know that celebrities, actors in particular, are obsessed with the kinds of roles they take. And there are actors who won't take roles that they feel like put them in a negative light because that's how people see them. Right. And that's their persona that they're honing constantly. And so that's their project. And maybe that's what they want to do. I don't know. But the other thing that I think here is, to tie all of this back together, you know, it's like we don't have great polling or data, as far as I know, on like the effect of celebrity endorsements on races. I mean, I will absolutely take Sarah Longwell's excellent focus groups, which are reliable, like often are the best data we have is just from these little focus groups. But we don't have large scale survey data over time, over multiple elections that I'm aware of, where we can say this clearly makes a difference, or it doesn't, or exactly, you know, sort of what and how it works in our politics. But I do think this election is about the economy and inflation, but it's also, as we've talked about a kind of backlash to elites, to liberal elites and liberal institutions. This is a backlash that is not just in the United States. It's all over the world right now. Basically, every Western democracy that has had an election, you know, in the post-inflation, post-COVID era, the voters have thrown out the incumbents. But part of that is not just we don't like incumbents. It's more than that. It's we don't like incumbents who are associated with a particular kind of idea and style and a particular sort of political culture that has been in vogue for the past 15 years or so. And I do.
And it's
think
also
that,
we don't yeah. like inflation, right? Yes, I right? mean, I think it's
so
really
it's,
important.
All tied.
Not to...
It is all of these things are tied up together. So absolutely, inflation. If you're going to pick a single specific issue, inflation's the number one issue, no question. But all of this is tied up, I think, with a kind of backlash to and a rejection of what I'm going to call
like millennial liberal cringe, part of which was created and encouraged by celebrities. And you go back to 2009, and one of the most famous ads from, I think it was 2009, I could be getting gear just off a little bit, was this thing put together by Demi Moore and Ashton Kutcher, where it was just this lineup of celebrities who were pledging allegiance to Obama. We have talked on this podcast about ObamaCore, not Obamacare, the healthcare program, but ObamaCore, the kind of the cultural vibe that surrounded the Obama years. And my read, again, it's, there's no data on this either. So I want to like, oh, Peter, where's your survey, your study? Like, I don't have it. So anybody want to challenge me on those grounds? I give up front. But my read of this election is that the cultural creative energy amongst non-left dissident types who are creatives online, they are absolutely pushing back against millennial cringe, against ObamaCore. And the celebrities who are participating in the, you know, oh, you should vote for Harris here at the end of the election cycle, maybe they're not making a big difference. But I do think that they are fueling the anti-ObamaCore, anti-millennial cringe backlash, at least a little bit, at least at the margins, at least amongst, you know, a particular subset of relatively young creative dissident types.
Yeah. I will say I had this weird premonition about what the result of the election was going to be when I don't know if you guys remember like Rachel Platten's fight song and the role that played in like sort of the Hillary campaign. And it started getting like auto fed to me in various Amazon playlists. And I was like, oh, no, this is bad. Bad things are coming.
Yeah. No, there's definitely, hey, look, and one data point that suggests Peter is on to something here is, what was the one generational cohort that Donald Trump most clearly won? It's Gen X, right? Gen X, the slacker generation. And look, we can make arguments like Gen X is, yeah, Gen,
so,
X
so
is
Gen
older.
Gen X over the line, but it was also people, particularly young men, but young women, as I understand, at least there's some, yes, data to suggest that young women swung a little towards Trump, but young men swung way towards Trump.
Totally, totally. Those gaps change. But again, it's like, you know, it's hard. Again, it's very hard to disaggregate any of these things, right? Which, when it comes down to questions of like, well, what are we, housing prices, you know, food prices, whatever. It's, you know, it's hard. It's hard.
But I mean, to bring it back to the prices thing and inflation. Yeah, we all agree inflation was the number one issue here, to the extent that you can sort of pin this on a traditional political issue. But celebrities, the thing about them that everybody at least assumes is true, they're rich. Like celebrities, yeah, are rich in, yeah, a way, yeah, yeah, that's like not even like political elites are rich. So like celebrities who you think of as like, oh, this is a C-list person. They live in a really expensive house in a, right, not every single case, but in so many of those cases. And
many,
even if it's
kids,
right, and people know that. And so when rich people are saying, hey, vote for the person who was in the administration when inflation spiked, it just doesn't, it's not going to work for a lot of people.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that celebrities endorsed Kamala Harris? Peter?
It's a non-controversy, honestly. Celebrities endorse Democrats, and people have a right to say what they want about politics, even if it's counterproductive to their own goals.
Alyssa?
Yeah, it's a non-controversy.
It's a non-controversy. There are some knock-on effects that we should keep in mind when we tweet things. Lord knows I don't tweet everything I think. You should see what's in the old noggin up here that doesn't make it onto Twitter. It's terrifying.
When we get a Neuralink in you, we're going to find out.
I just text you guys all my bad thoughts. I'm not on basically not on social media anymore. This is what the group chat is for.
You're not supposed to admit that, Alyssa.
Yeah, it's going to be bad when our phones get hacked. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode this Friday. We're going to be talking about best movies of the decade so far. Will Anora be on the list? Who can say? Speaking of which, on to the main event. Anora, as directed by Sean Baker, most recently of Red Rocket and the Florida Project fame, and starring Mikey Madison as the titular Anora, a.k.a. Annie, I found the film to be riveting and fascinating, if occasionally a little loosey-goosey in that middle section. The setup is pretty straightforward. Annie is a dancer at Manhattan Topless Club HQ. While working there, she is asked to do a private dance with Ivan, who's played by Mark Edelstein, who looks kind of, I've seen him described as a Russian Timothy Chalamet. I like that description a lot. He's a wealthy Russian. He's quickly quickly smitten with the girl who knows a little Russian and a lot about pleasing men. He asks her to come to his home for some off-location work, and we come to learn he is the scion of a Russian oligarch. He offers her $10,000 for an exclusive week of her time. She says yes, though negotiates him up slightly, and by the end of it, they're flying off to Vegas and getting married. By the end of that week, anyway. When news of this marriage trickles back to Ivan's parents, they send family fixer Toros, who's played by Karen Karigulian, I think. Is how you pronounce that? And goons Garnik, played by Vash Tovmaisen, and Igor, played by Yura Borisov, to figure out what's going on and how to stop it. Yada, yada, yada. Ivan makes a break for it, and the movie shifts over the next 80 minutes or so to Annie and the goons searching New York for Ivan. It's like a different movie, like set in, nestled into the middle of this other movie, right? It's like part Cassavetes' Urban Odyssey, part Coen Brothers' farce. By the end of it, everyone is exhausted and nobody is happy. I wrote about this in my review.
Great but movie for an election week.
Yeah, well, I feel like this movie gets to a lot of what America will be experiencing over the next few years here, but we can maybe discuss that more. As I wrote in my review, the one thing I really like about this movie and Sean Baker's movies in general is his clear-eyed sympathy. And what I mean by that is that his films often focus on people in lines of work considered to be unsavory, right? So prostitution here and in the Florida Project, or pornography in Red Rocket. Yet he never obscures either the humanity of those involved or the fact that they are in bad situations largely because they have made bad choices and are currently making bad choices and bad decisions. The fact that this movie opens and closes with Annie delivering a lap dance and the difference in her emotional states each time is quite intentional, I think. Look, people talk about Baker being a non-judgmental director, and I think that's true to a certain extent, but I also think that her reaction to realizing what her life has led her to and her breaking down in tears at the end of it is not coincidental. It helps that every actor involved is delivering top-notch work. You can't say enough about Madison's turn here. Edelstein's callow Ivan is just the perfect mixture of childishly impulsive and casually destructive. And I love the two Armenians and one Russian who join Annie through her sojourn, particularly Borisov's work as Igor. He constantly has this look of, like, quiet bemusement on his face, right? He's like not quite sure how he got here or why Annie hates him so much. He's just doing his job. He got roped into this thing without really asking for any of it. He's like basically trying to be a decent guy in a bad situation, but also is vaguely contemptuous of everybody involved. The work he does with his face in this movie is some of my favorite quiet acting work I've seen in a very long time. The 2 hours and 20 minutes of this film is worth it, particularly for Igor. Anyway, Peter, what did you make of Anora?
I loved this movie, and it's been several days now since I've seen it, and the more I think about it, the more I like it. And one of the big things that I like about this movie is that it is a movie that asks us the question, what we owe to each other. And this is very much a film about debt and obligations. And so at the beginning of the movie, you see Annie, Anora, connect with Ivan, and she is in his employ. Like he offers her $10,000. She negotiates it up to $15,000, kind of amusingly a pretty direct nod to Pretty Woman, which is a movie that, because the same thing happens in Pretty Woman. And this is a movie that very much riffs on Pretty Woman and sort of offers a gritty but not dark or, sort of grim revision, version of the same idea. And so at first she's in his employ and she comes to realize that sort of comes with expectations, right? Like, oh, you've just got to be at his beck and call because you are always doing the performance of yourself. She doesn't get a break in that situation as long as she's around him, right? And so it's interestingly contrasted with what is the moment when she is actually called to him the first time. She's in the break room at the strip club eating her food, right, out of a little Tupperware container. And it's so much of this movie is just sort of making this point that it's all work. And then, of course, in the middle section of the movie,
As you said, that it's, you know, becomes this four-parter with the fixers and with Annie and with the oligarch's son, Ivan, missing from the picture. And what you realize is that all of them are in this kind of debt obligations situation to the family. And they're all trying to make it somehow or another, trying to extract the money, get the job done, not get screwed. I mean, in a both a metaphorical sense and a literal sense in some ways. And they all end up kind of having to work together. And so this is a kind of fascinating movie about the about a kind of working class and what joins them, but also what divides them. And it's that middle part of the film that I think really makes it. I liked the opening act and the third act. I think they're great. Like, and they really do a fantastic job of bookending the middle section. But I think it is the middle hour and 15 minutes or so of this film, from the moment when the fixers show up and Ivan runs off. And so first it is this kind of scene where the fixers are trying to get control of Annie. And then it becomes this just kind of hilarious journey through crazy New York, through modern the ethnic enclaves of New York, and all of these establishments of kind of where people go to gather, but we're also where they go to work, right? And we eat, you know, so we go into a restaurant and we go into the back part of it and talk to somebody who's working on the line. We go into a diner and you've got the old Armenian guy who is like just bitching with like these younger guys who are sitting around the table and being a little bit rude to him, but also he's like totally, he's being a little rude too. Like everybody's kind of being a little bit rude to each other, and there's just this kind of fascinating culture clash that you see in this, the way that it draws out just tiny little details and specifics about all of these little groups and the ways that they are aligned and that the ways they are alike, but also the ways in which economic incentives and alignments and obligations sort of force them to work against each other. And at the end, as you said, it's a story about how Honora realizes what kind of life she's going to have because she wasn't able to become and she wasn't able to the thing she thought was going to release her from that was being part of a family, because families have different obligations to each other, and the family just wasn't going to have it, was not going to accept that. And so it's just an absolutely wonderful and joyful movie. And it just this amazing tonal balancing job where it manages to really show you how dark and how in some ways how difficult her life is. There's abuse. There's all sorts of stuff that people would, you know, I mean, there's violence in that section where the fixers are trying to sort of get her in line. But it's also, it manages to do it without just being depressing and grim and awful. This is a very, very like exuberantly funny movie at times in a way that is just incredibly rare. I loved it.
There's a very interesting, I think Sean Baker has actually talked about this a little bit, but there's a very interesting little facet of this film, which is that when you, despite the fact that you're essentially dealing with there's a version of this movie where these are Russian gangsters and everybody has guns and it changes the calculus of the threat and the violence. And because you don't have that here, because it's like everybody kind of trying to be, you know, businessmen kind of more or less, despite the fact that this guy's a Russian oligarch arms dealer, possibly, or, you know, oil baron. It's not 100% clear. You know, the lack of firearms changes the tenor of everything involved. Alyssa, what did you make of Honora?
Oh, I love this movie so much. And I think the point that both of you have made about this being a movie about work is spot on. And in fact, Justin Chang's review of Honora in The New Yorker has what I think is one of the all-time best New Yorker style headlines. It's Twerker's Comp, which is just like, is fabulous.
That's very good. That's very clever.
Right. I mean, just, you know, Justin, copy editor of The New Yorker, whoever wrote that, like, good on ya. And I think that intersects with the movie's morality in some really interesting ways. Because, Sonny, you know, you talked about the sort of, I think what you seem to have seen as sort of some moral condemnation at the end of the movie. And I'm not sure that what Honora is coming to terms with is the idea that, like, sex work is degrading or that what she's done is bad. Instead, I think the movie is making sort of a larger point about Americans' relationship to work, which is that it is a mistake to see work as something other than work, right? Like work, like her mistake is not in taking Vanya's money or even working at headquarters in the first place, but in confusing work for family, for something that's going to provide her with sort of deeper emotional fulfillment from something that is, you know, going to sort of uphold her ideals in any way. And Sunny, I also thought it was sort of interesting that you refer to the final sex scene between her and Igor, so sorry, spoilers, as a lap dance, because I did not interpret
it. That's how it starts. That's 100% how it starts, and then it goes from there.
I don't agree. I don't entirely agree with that. It's just, it's so different in every way in the contact that she has with Ivan and the other customers at the club. Like, I mean, she's facing him for most of that interaction. I think it's notable given that, like, we see her, you know, the first time she has sex with Ivan, like, being, like, you know, insisting that they use a condom. Like, she's not, pretty obviously, like, not using protection in that sequence. It's just, it's, like, it seems to me like she has an orgasm in that scene where you, like, you never see her. Like, in fact, it's, like, pretty clear that Ivan is bad in bed. I just found that scene so different.
Can I interject one thing here? All right, again, fully spoilers for if you want to see the movie, just stop listening if you haven't already stopped listening. But how does that scene start? That scene starts with him giving her the diamond ring. It starts with him giving her a thing of value and her immediately responding by climbing on top of him and grinding on him. And this is exactly what happens in the strip clubs. And I'm sorry, there is a sequence in the strip club where she takes off her underwear. Remember, she's like, I'm not supposed to be doing this. Yeah. You know, this is too. And what happens at the, so what happens in the scene, she gets the ring. She receives this thing of monetary value. Her only reaction, her only relationship to sex and money is to repay that act with an act of sexual gratification. She does it and immediately starts crying at the end of it because she's like, this is what my life is. Maybe that is not what Baker intended in this sequence, but it seems to me a very clear moment of like her realizing that her work has messed her up in a real way and like damaged her ability to interact with people in a non-degrading way. That's just my read on the scene.
I do think it's a warped, it's intended to be a warped reflection of the opening shot and the opening scene, right? It is the same, but totally different. It is, in some ways, we're supposed to understand part of it is about the, I think, I don't know if I quite agree, Sunny, that it is her realizing that her work has messed her up, but it is showing us that that she does not have the ability to move back and forth, and maybe there is no way to kind of completely separate your personal and romantic feelings and your transactional feelings, because it's not just that she gets an object of value and responds with a lap dance. It's that she's given a wedding ring. It is a kind of, it is this sort of metaphorical ghost of a proposal, this kind of non-proposal with this guy who has been on the one hand, like, I mean, he definitely assaulted her. And on the other hand, he's the sweetest person in the movie and the only person with whom she develops a real and genuine, intimate and emotional connection. And that's part of the movie's point, is that you can't separate these things. And she does not have that ability because she is now entering into this, again, metaphorically, a second marriage with him. But it is, what is it? She doesn't know. These things can't be pulled apart.
I also interpreted The Ring as like the two of them having gotten something over on Ivan and his parents, right? Like, it's a sort of, you know, it resets her relationship to her work to a certain extent. And it's like the team that they're on together is of people who are in the employ of this kind of class of person. And it's interesting also that in the depiction of Ivan's parents, right, it's like his mother, Galina Stepanova, who's like entirely sort of businesslike and the sort of enforcer of the family's sort of reputation and performances. Like, Ivan's dad shows up and like finds Honora's takedown of his wife like kind of hilarious. But like, he's the source of the money, but not the sort of enforcer of the family's image and relationships. And like, he's never the one who's on the phone, right? It's like, there is like, oh God, wait till your father hears about this. But like, the person who's on the phone the entire time is Galina. You know, and is, yeah, I don't know. I think it's so terrific. I sort of can't wait to watch it again. Because it does so many different things, right? I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about that sort of central fight sequence that, you know, I said to Peter when we were walking into the theater that in some ways the mark of great direction is sort of calibration and the Baker's ability to pull something off and have it be genuinely kind of, you know, there's a feeling of actual like threat and menace and people get hurt, but it's also just incredibly funny.
Yeah. It's just very, very Coen Brothers. Like, that whole sequence is like, it's not shot in a Coen Brothers style. It's less locked down than they do, but it has the sensibility of a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah. And again, you know, the henchman coming back with like this bag of like frozen, you know, Russian dumplings or whatever.
Pierogies. Little pierogies.
I think pierogies, they look really small to me, pierogies.
They look like pierogies to me, but maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah, maybe totally there's another variety of dumpling that we should be aware. But yeah, I mean, the way the movie pulls that off, the way the, you know, you can sort of see what's coming with Igor and Honora, even as the movie doesn't sort of lean on it too hard. It's such a treat. And even as it's, you know, sad and sour, I mean, and God, the sequences of Ivan just like, turning immediately to video games after sex and Honora sort of being there is like, okay, I guess my job is to be an accessory and to be sort of physically attached to him as he's playing video games. And her attempts to sort of insist, it's like, this is a real marriage, right? And it's like, even if this wasn't sort of a ridiculous, farcical green card marriage, like, they're both two children, right?
Yeah. Well, this is another thing that I find really interesting about the movie is, like, her repeated insistence that, like, we're married, we're husband and wife, and everybody else understanding that that's ridiculous. And my big question is, and I honestly am not sure how I come down on this, but my big question is how much did she actually believe this was a real marriage? Because it's, like, I'm sorry. Like, she gets so mad in this movie when she's described as an escort, as a prostitute, right? She hears Toros on the phone describe her as an escort, and she's like, what did he call me? But it's literally what she is. That's like, it's not, I'm sorry you find it insulting because, you know, you got married in Vegas or whatever, but, like, I it's not wrong. It's not an incorrect description, precisely.
Well, part of that is just to make her a more winning character. That sort of rejection adds to her, you know, the aggressiveness of her kind of the way she was, you know, of her character. And but also, like, it allows you to see that she's fooling herself a little bit, but also that she has some dignity, that she is not allowing herself, like, she might even call herself that. But the point is that she objects to it when it is used by these people who are using it as a way to dismiss her and diminish her.
But I do think there is a sense that, like, she and Ivan are both sort of, I don't know, morally or socially impoverished people, right? And the difference between the two of them ends up being that she's someone who is kind of interested in putting some meat on the performance, right? Like, she, and he's the one who runs, right? He's the one who, you know, had no real interest in being anything other than the person that he is.
Well, he's a child. I mean, yeah. he's a child in the whole movie. Like, he breaks, like, I think the way I described it in my review is he breaks the relationship like it's a toy that he can just throw away. And, like, it's no big, because he can walk away from this because he will still have his money and she doesn't.
Right. And, I mean, like, Ivan's parents also come across as, like, you know, the adults in the movie, the parents in this movie, you know, we never hear a reference to Honora's father. Her mother is in, like, Miami with her man, like, clearly not someone who's even a meaningful stepfather figure. You know, Ivan's parents are letting him just squander huge amounts of money and screw around the United States. Like, the, you know, it's, I mean, I think one of the most... There are many ways in which this movie is an interesting sort of warped mirror and commentary on Pretty Woman, but among it is that the people with money have no class, right? And in Pretty Woman, the sort of it's the, you know, kind of mid-level, you know, management person who turns out to be both sort of a moral and physical thug, when in fact here it's the people who are kind of in the employ of these rich people who turn out to have just a bit more decency than everyone else. And as an aside, it's also really interesting that this movie doesn't feature a sort of makeover sequence in the same way that Pretty Woman does, right?
Like, well, there is the moment where he takes her to buy clothes. She buys the big coat thing, right?
He buys her the coat. But her clothes don't fundamentally change. Like, the makeover sequence in Pretty Woman is sort of a huge jump from one kind of classed dressing to another, right? And there is a scene where Julia Roberts' character, like, returns to a boutique that she was basically thrown out of in much fancier clothing with her hair done a different way. And, you know, goes to the saleswoman, is like, a big mistake, huge. But part of what is fascinating about the sort of lack of a makeover sequence in Honora is the extent to which the aesthetics of sex work and sort of mainstream dressing have kind of merged, right? Like, the very overdone, like, the very fancy, like, long nails with nail art, the bandage dress that she's wearing when she goes to Ivan's house for the first time. It's like a completely sort of standard, you know, piece of clothing. Like, the bandage dress was just sort of a staple of dressing kind of across class lines in, like, the late teens to sort of early 20s in women's fashion. And the sort of collapse of those aesthetics is just a really interesting kind of side note in the movie. Like, he buys her something expensive, but he doesn't buy her something that is a different class marker. And his mother does dress differently, but that's more sort of an age question than sort of a class delineation.
Yeah. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Honora? Peter?
Big thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Huge thumbs up, one of my favorite things I've seen this year.
Good movie, thumbs up. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.